We're discussing why Moshe Rabbeinu's name doesn't appear in Seder Tetzaveh. They say that Moshe Rabbeinu, when God had threatened to destroy the Jewish people by the sin of the golden calf, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, if you forgive them, fine, and if not, Mecheni no misifrecha asher kosavta, wipe my name, erase my name out of your book. Some say that that means that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted his name erased from the Torah if the Jewish people would not be forgiven. And we know that whatever a tzaddik says, even if he says it on condition, makes an impression, and it has an effect. So even though God did not destroy the Jewish people, but Moshe Rabbeinu's name was erased from one sedra. Now why this sedra? Why tzaddik? So they say a very cute idea. The sedra that Moshe Rabbeinu said that in was Kisisa, which is next week's sedra. So God said, I'm not going to erase his name from this sedra, let's wait till next week. Next week came Vayakel, God said, you know what, let's wait till next week. And he kept doing this week after week and pushing it off until the very last sedra before it starts again the cycle, which is this week, Tetzaveh. So therefore, he had no choice, and he had to take Moshe Rabbeinu's name out of the very last in the cycle, Tetzaveh. Okay, I have a different idea. Why Moshe Rabbeinu's name does not appear? It has to do with this idea that he said Mecheni no misifrecha, but not for that reason. In order to understand it, we have to go back to another episode in the Torah. When God told Moshe Rabbeinu to go and redeem the Jewish people, so Moshe Rabbeinu refused. And he had all different kinds of excuses. For 7 days, he argued with the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm not the one, I can't speak, and so on and so on. And finally, on the 7th day, Moshe Rabbeinu's true colors came out. What was the real reason why he was resisting? Shlach no bi'atishlach. Send my brother Aaron. I don't want to slight my brother. Till now, all the missions that God had for a prophet in Egypt were carried out through Aaron, and now the big mission comes to redeem the Jewish people, and Aaron gets passed over, no pun intended, and Moshe Rabbeinu is the little brother, is given the big mission. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I feel that I'm hurting my brother's feelings. He's going to feel slighted. I don't want to hurt his feelings. So give him the mission. Don't give it to me. God gets angry with him, and seemingly he's punished. What's his punishment? Aaron achicha ha-Levi. Aaron should have been the Levi, and you should have been the Kohen. But now, because you said this, Aaron's going to be the Kohen, and you're going to be the Levi. That seems a little difficult to understand why Moshe Rabbeinu would be punished for being so sensitive to his brother's feelings. In fact, the Bali Musar say that we see from here how important it is not to hurt people's feelings, that Moshe Rabbeinu was willing to give up the mission of redeeming the Jewish people. Maybe there would be no redemption, but it was worth it not to hurt Aaron's feelings. And Moshe's punished for that? And he loses the kahuna because of that? Why? So let me tell you what I think. There are two levels of serving God. There's a level called Yira, we serve God out of fear. And then there's a level of Ava, where you serve God out of love. Now, on a simplistic idea, fear means I'm afraid God's going to zap me with a lightning bolt, so I better do what he wants. Love is, I love God, and therefore I'll do what he wants. But it's not so simple. Fear does not mean that I'm afraid God's going to zap me with a lightning bolt. Fear is a different, same idea, but much more sophisticated. And it can be brought out in the following way. The Kotzker Rebbe once saw one of his Hasidim saying the Shema with great intention, great kavan. And he was saying, V'ohavtas Hashem Elokech, he said, love God. After davening, the Kotzker Rebbe went to the Chassid, and he said to him, when you said that you should love God, did you mean that you love God or that you love yourself? The Chassid said, I don't understand. How in the world could I mean I love myself when I said I love God? So I'll tell you how. When a person says he loves herring, What does he mean? Carries a little fish in his pocket and every once in a while gives it a kiss and a hug? That's not what he means. What he means is, herring tastes good. He likes to eat things that taste good. So what is he really saying? He loves himself. And he loves himself, and therefore he loves to eat herring because herring makes him feel good. Maybe that's what you meant. When you said you love God, you didn't mean you love God. It means that you've come to the conclusion that doing what God wants is good for you. And if you don't do it, it's not going to be good for you. You're not going to have the reward that you could get. You're going to get punished. Whatever it is, you've come to the conclusion that serving God is good for you. So when you say you love God, you don't really love God. You love you. Or maybe you know. Maybe you love God. And they're really two different levels. One level is total love of the Rebbe Shalom. It's not me. It doesn't start with me. There's a level that says, Ritzoneinu lasos ritzonecha. My will is to do your will. But I have my will first. First I decide what's good for me. And I've come to the conclusion that doing what God wants me to do is good for me. So really, it starts with what's good for me, but I want to do what God says because I think that's what's good for me. Now, that is a very high level. Halavai, we should be on that level. Most of us, unfortunately, many times think what's good for us is what God doesn't want us to do. So if we'd be on the level that we'd always come to the conclusion that what's good for us is what God wants us to do, we'd be on a very nice level. But it's not the highest level. The level is what is reflected by the following, Chazal. Asei ritzono kirtzonecha. Make God's will your will. It doesn't start with me. What I want, what's good for me. It starts with God's will. And I accommodate myself to God's will, whether it's good for me or not. That's irrelevant. I want to do it because it's right. Because I love God and I feel that I owe him so much because I exist only because of him. I want to fulfill his will. Two different...
The next line, whatever that says,
God should protect you too from other people's wills that are negative against you. No, it doesn't say that. It says Kadeshi Yavatu Ritzon Achirim. It says Vato Ritzon from your Ritzon again. You're right. In any case, because then your will be God's will. So do what you want to, because not for your sake, but because you want what he wants. Those are two levels. Ava means that you love God altruistically. And Yira means you're afraid that you'll lose out if you don't do God's will. It doesn't have to be that you'll be zapped with a lightning bolt. But you feel that you will be wanting if you don't do what God wants. But it's based on what's good for you. One of the differences on what level you're on, and very few people are on this high level. The Ramban says that there were a few people in history that reached that tremendous level of Ava totally. Avraham Avinu was one of them. Rabbi Akiva was another. But the very few personalities in Jewish history reached that tremendously high level perfectly. In any case, one of the differences whether a person's on this level or that level would be the following. Before I get to the difference, let me tell you that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was upset with the Jewish people that they weren't on that level. When the Torah was given and the Rebbeinu Shlom spoke directly to the Jewish people, they got scared. And they said, if we continue listening to God speak to us directly, we may die. So they said, you know what, Moshe? You speak to God and tell us what he had to say. We can't take the risk anymore of speaking directly to God. Who knows what's going to happen? Our neshamas will just leave us. So Moshe came to God and he complained. These people, it's more important to them that they continue living than then speak to God. Wouldn't it be better that you have this tremendous love? I want to speak to God directly, so I'll die. They're more concerned about their being around than having the opportunity to speak to God another few seconds. Do you know what God told Moshe? Halavai. Miyiten. Halavai. Sheyiyeh levavam zeli yiro sikolayom. Halavai, they should be on this level all time to fear me. In other words, that they're concerned, self-concerned. They're concerned about themselves. Not selfless love. Self-concerned love. But so what? So they're self-concerned. That's a high level too. So don't be upset with them. not the highest level, but it's a nice level. To be love God out of self-concern. What's one of the differences, whether you love God because of self-concern or selfless? The difference can be brought out with the following story. They once asked the Rebbe Reb Zusha if he could switch places with Avraham Avinu. He would become Avraham Avinu, and Avraham Avinu would become the Rebbe Reb Zusha. Okay, not being a chassid, I have my problems with that story, because why didn't they ask Avraham Avinu if he wanted to switch places with Reb Zusha? Why did they ask Reb Zusha if he wanted to switch places with Avraham? In any case, okay, chassidim don't ask that question. So in any case, they asked Reb Zusha. He thought about it, and he said, no, he wouldn't do it. They asked him, why not? Wouldn't you want to be Avraham Avinu? He said, what would God gain? There'd still be one Avraham Avinu and one Zusha. I have to be Avraham Avinu. Let Avraham Avinu be Avraham Avinu. Right? God will gain the same thing whether I'm Avraham Avinu and he's Zusha, or I'm Zusha and he's Avraham Avinu. So the main thing over here is not what I can do. The main thing is, what's God going to gain in this world from it? So why, I have to be the star. I have to be Avraham Avinu. No, I'll be Zusha. I'll do what I'm supposed to do. In the end, God will gain the same thing. The world will gain the same thing. One more preface, and then we'll put this all together. The rabbis say, "Hachoshed b'ksheirim lo kebegufa." If someone suspects someone else wrongly, I'm suspicious of someone and suspect them of doing something wrong, and I'm wrong. They didn't do this thing; it was wrong. I made a mistake. Then lo kebegufa, simple meaning, I get punished. I get hit in my body. The person who suspects somebody else wrongly gets hit in his body. The simple meaning is he gets punished for it. You should give somebody the benefit of the doubt. Don't suspect people wrongly. But I have a different idea why that's the case. If I suspect someone who did something wrong, they did something suspicious, and my suspicions were well-founded, then what brought me to suspect them? Their actions. But if their actions were in fact innocent, then why did I think that person did something wrong? You know why? Because I transfer how I think about myself to them. Give me an example. I see somebody sneaking out of a house in the morning. Okay. Now, it could be that he's trying to avoid a big, ferocious dog. That's why he's sneaking out of the house. Could be he just robbed the house, and that's why he's sneaking out. Now, if I assume that the guy robbed the house, and it's wrong. He's sneaking out because of the dog. Now, why did I assume that he was robbing the house? You know why? Not because his actions made me think that, but because I thought to myself that if I would be doing that, probably I would have robbed the house. In other words, I imagined that I could do such a thing, and therefore I transfer how it would have been with me to him.
Oh, projection.
Right. Projection. I project to him. So that's the case. Hachoshed b'ksheir, if somebody suspects someone else wrongly, it's not coming from the other person, it's coming from the person's own feelings about themselves. And that's loke b'gufa, something is blemished, something's wrong with you. Now let's put this all together. When God told Moshe Rabbeinu to go and redeem the Jewish people, and Moshe Rabbeinu suspected that Aaron's feelings would be hurt, that means he suspected that Aaron was functioning on a level of self-concern. Hey, I want to be the big shot and redeem the Jewish people. I don't want my little brother to do it. But Aaron was not guilty of that at all. Aaron, it says, God told Moshe, "V'ro'acha v'samach b'libo." When Aaron sees you, that you've been chosen as the redeemer, he'll be happy in his heart. Not he'll have a smile on his face and inside he'll be eating him up alive. He'll be happy through and through. He'll be happy in his heart for you. He doesn't have one jealous bone in his body. He won't be jealous. It won't dawn on him there's something to be jealous of. What difference does it make if I'm the redeemer or Moshe's the redeemer? Somebody's redeeming the Jewish people. It makes a difference who it is. But Moshe Rabbeinu suspected Aaron. Why? It wasn't because he saw something in Aaron, because Aaron was innocent. So where did it come from? Moshe Rabbeinu's projection of his own feelings. Meaning, Moshe said to himself, if the tables would be turned, and I'd be the older brother, and I'd be the older brother, and Aaron would be the younger brother, and he would have gotten the mission. I would have felt bad. So he imagined that Aaron would feel bad.
Yeah,
one second. That Moshe Rabbeinu was Anav Mikol HaAdam when the Torah says he was. But Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't born perfect. Grew. And Moshe Rabbeinu was not a perfect human being, because there are no perfect human beings. So Moshe Rabbeinu had faults also, and he corrected them. So at that point, he wasn't yet on that highest level. Like he said, there's only few individuals in history. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't, he got to that level eventually, but not then. So therefore the Rabbanu Shlom said to him, you can no longer be a Kohen. A Kohen is God's representative and the Jewish people's representative. He has no identity of his own. He is totally negated and subjugated to the one who sends him, either the Jewish people or God. He represents both. He's total representative. He has to have no ego. He has to be totally negated and subjugated to God and to the Jewish people. He's a mesharis, he's a servant, a minister. No personal ego. It's all selfless. Moshe Rabbeinu, if you could project to Aaron that Aaron would feel bad, that he was slighted and not picked as the Redeemer, that means that by you, that is how you would feel. You can't be a Kohen. On the other hand, Aaron wouldn't feel like that at all. I know that he'll feel happy through and through. He could be the Kohen. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu lost the kahuna. Aaron got it, but Moshe Rabbeinu corrected the blemish. When? After the sin of the golden calf, when Moshe Rabbeinu was praying for the Jewish people, what did he say? If you forgive the Jewish people, fine. If not, erase my name from the Torah. I have no existence on my own. I am a total servant of the Jewish people, and if they don't exist, then I don't exist. That means that he totally fixed up that blemish. He no longer had any personal identity. He was a total servant of Klal Yisrael, when he said, Mechenina. Therefore, he was fit to be a Kohen again. And in fact, he was a Kohen. During the entire 40 years of the desert, according to some opinions, and surely during the 7 days when the Kohanim were inducted, Moshe Rabbeinu acted as the Kohen. And some say that it went on for the 40 years. Moshe himself was elevated to be a Kohen. He functioned as a Kohen. He just lost the kahuna for his children, because it was given to Aaron. Aaron's children got it. Moshe, it stopped with him. God wanted to do Moshe Rabbeinu a favor. So in this week's Sedra, which deals with the induction of Aaron and his children into the kahuna, the making of the special clothing for them, and the last part of the Sedra deals with how to induct them into the kahuna. One would think that Moshe Rabbeinu would feel bad. Ah, I could have been the Kohen, right? And Aaron got it. So the Rabban Shem wanted us to know that Moshe Rabbeinu corrected that flaw, that blemish. And in this week's Sedra, when Aaron is made the Kohen, Moshe Rabbeinu does not feel slight. How do I know? Because his name isn't even mentioned in the Sedra to tell me that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't consider himself Moshe. He's just another you. And therefore it doesn't make a difference if it's this you that is the Kohen or this you that's the Kohen. Moshe Rabbeinu is only a pronoun. He doesn't have any of that personal identity that could be, I want to be and not somebody else. I'm just another you. And if God has this you being the Kohen, he doesn't need this you to be the Kohen. It's not Moshe and Aaron. It's a bunch of soldiers in God's army. As long as somebody does the mission, that's fine with me. So not as a punishment, as a reward for Moshe Rabbeinu, God left his name out of the Sedra, which is the induction of the Kohanim, to show me that Moshe Rabbeinu did not feel slighted, had no compunctions about inducting Aaron to be the Kohen, and didn't feel at all bad that he lost the Kohanim. As long as there's a Kohen, it's fine with me. Even if Aaron's the one. That could be a reason why Moshe's name does not appear in this week's Sedra, specifically this Sedra. Go to something else. Something else from the Sedra, and then a little bit about Purim. It says there are two functions of the clothing of the Kohanim. The first function is l'kadsho l'kahanovi, to sanctify the Kohen, in order that he should be able to serve as a Kohen. And the Gemara says, b'geyam aleihem kunosam aleihem. If they are wearing their special clothing, then they have the status of Kohanim, and they can serve in the Beis Hamikdash. And if they're not wearing their special clothing, vis-a-vis the sacrifices in the Beis Hamikdash, they're not Kohanim. They have to have that clothing on. If they don't, then they're just like any other Jew. They're unfit to make sacrifices. So the clothing somehow brings out their holiness. And yet, it says that the clothing is also the cover of the Tiferes. It's for an honor and the glory, according to many, of the Kohen. So which is it? Is it honor and glory, or is it to bring out their holiness? Clothing in general. What is the function of clothing? Why do we wear clothing? So one function is that before the sin of Adam and Chava, Taka, they didn't wear clothing. It was only a result of the sin of Adam and Chava. Why? Because before the sin of Adam and Chava, it was clear that human beings are neshamas. We are souls who are clothed in a body in this physical world, meaning the following. We were all created thousands of years ago as souls, and we existed as souls in a spiritual world underneath God's throne, whatever that means, and we could function very nicely as souls in a spiritual world. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without legs and so on. When we came into this physical world, we couldn't function anymore in a physical world as a soul. We needed a body to be able to function. You know what it's like? An astronaut. An astronaut, as long as he's on terra firma, so on this planet, he doesn't need any special suit or apparatus to exist. He can breathe, he can see, he can talk, he can get around, fine. He goes into outer space, the environment is not compatible for a human being. There's no oxygen, so he needs an oxygen apparatus to breathe. There's no air pressure, so he needs a pressurized suit. And there's no sound waves, so he needs a radio to communicate with. He comes back to Earth, takes off the suit, doesn't need it anymore. So too. As long as we were neshamas in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without any physical body. But when our neshamas came into this physical world, we needed a space suit, an inner space suit, to function, called the body. We need eyes to see and ears to hear, but we're not bodies. We are souls who are clothed in bodies in order to function in the physical world. Therefore, when we go back to the spiritual world, we leave the body here. And it could be for that reason we demonstrate and manifest mourning for someone who died by tearing our clothing. It symbolizes the fact it's only the clothing that's been torn away. But the essence of the person is still there. Except he's in a spiritual world. He doesn't need a body anymore. So before the sin of Adam and Chava, it was clear that the body was the essence of the human being. And the soul was the essence of the human being, and the body was merely a suit of clothing that the soul wore. But once Adam and Chava sinned, they use their body against their soul, not in detrimental to the soul, against the soul. So now it's not clear anymore. Is the body just a suit of clothing that serves the soul? Why is the body rebelling against the soul? And maybe there is no soul. You can't see it. All you see is the body. Maybe there's only a body. Because the body can't be just a servant of the soul, because it functions independently against the soul too. Not in the soul's best interest. So now it becomes confusing. Is, what's the body? What's the main thing? The body, the soul, is there a soul? I can't see it. All I see is a body. So in order to make the statement that there's more here than meets the eye, after the sin of Adam and Chava, it became necessary to wear clothing. Beged. The word beged means to rebel. A traitor. Bogey. Right? Bogadnu. Because we rebelled our bodies against our soul, we need to wear clothing. What does the clothing say? The clothing distracts attention from the external, and it makes the following statement. That I am not a body. There's more here than meets the eye. And you have to therefore take in consideration that what you can't see is more significant than what you can see, and therefore I wear clothing to distract attention from the externals and to direct attention towards the internal that's not seeable. There's only one problem with that. That is the concept of tznius. Tznius is not covering a body that is that's bad, erotic, dirty. Chas v'shalom. Body is a creation of God. Nothing wrong with it. But and we don't demand that animals cover their bodies. We don't go to the zoo only if the animals are clothed. Why? Because wherever there is an inner kedusha, and you could be distracted by the externals, they are attracting, we cover them. And we say, don't be distracted by the externals here. There's something that you can't see that is the main thing here. That's my neshama. By an animal, there is nothing more than the body. The animal doesn't have a neshama. There's nothing to cover. What you see is what you get. There's no reason to cover the body. Body's not bad. It's just that it could be misleading. And you want to distract attention from what could direct your attention to the body and attract it to that there's more here than meets the eye. In fact, it says that when the Mishkan was completed, God said, "Kan yofa hatznius." Here, modesty is extra special. And therefore the Mishkan was covered like a bike. It had a train in the back and a veil in the front. Now what was erotic about the Mishkan? It had to be covered. Same idea though. Depends what you look at the Mishkan. I heard a story once, descendant of Sholem Shvadron, one of his children, the grandchildren, was at the Kosel on Shabbos, and he sees an Israeli writing a tefillah on Shabbos and putting it in the wall. So he went over to him. He thought maybe there's somebody sick in his house, and he thinks this is Pikuach Nefesh, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos, somebody's in dire need of a refuah, and this he thinks is okay. So he said, "What are you doing? Shabbos." He said, "I'm the captain of an Israeli soccer team, and we have a championship match this week, and I was putting a request in the wall that we win." Now, if that's how you look at the Kosel HaMaravi, or at the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan, a magical wall that answers requests, then it's no different between mirror, mirror on the wall, or wall, wall on the ground. It's all the same thing. It borders on idolatry. What is the Mishkan and the Mikdash all about? God's presence. It's not the building. It's not a magical building. It houses God's presence. So therefore, we cover the externals in order to make the statement there's more here than meets the eye. Don't be distracted by the gold and the silver on the outside. There's something here inside that's more significant. That is the concept of tznius. It applies to human beings. It applies to the Mishkan. Applies to any situation where there's an inner spiritual value and you don't want to be distracted by the externals. Okay. In any case, if that's the case, then why do we wear clothing, the kind of clothing that we do? Why do we wear the kind of clothing that we do? We should better totally cover the and negate the externals. We should wear tents. It's just two little eyes coming out, but a tent around us so we don't even know we have a body. The clothing we wear is form-fitting. It shows you have a body. You see arms and legs and a torso. What? If the whole idea is to negate the body and distract attention from it. The answer is that there's a second purpose of clothing. Gemara says that clothing is called mechabdusi, that which honors me. It reflects my honor. And you know, people wear uniforms, it reflects who they are. A doctor wears a doctor's uniform, a nurse uniform, a policeman, a police uniform, and the uniform projects their inner importance. If you see a policemen in Bermuda shorts and a flowery shirt like they dress in Miami, right? You just don't have the same respect for him as if he's in the police uniform. There used to be doctors in Miami that would make rounds in shorts and in a flowery shirt. You just couldn't have the same respect for the doctor if he was in a white coat, you know, with a dressed properly with a stethoscope around his neck. He looked like a doctor. If not, he looked like maybe one of the attendants in the hospital. So what a person wears projects, a soldier wears a uniform, projects a certain cover. So the clothing projects an image, meaning the following. really the clothing are there to distract attention from the external body. But once you do that, it does reflect what the inner importance of that person is. That is brought out in the following way. The Vilna Gaon explains the following pasuk: Sheker hachein, the hevel hayofi, isha yiras Hashem itisala. Yofi and chein, beauty and charm, are false and vain. A woman who fears God, she should be praised, says the Vilna Gaon. When is beauty and charm false and vain? When there's nothing more, when it's only external, it's only skin deep. But isha yiras Hashem, but in a woman who fears God, she should be extolled for her beauty and her charm. Now what does that mean? What beauty are we talking about? Beauty is a very subjective thing. In one culture, one thing is considered beautiful, a different culture, something else may be considered beautiful. By the Ubangi warriors, they have a quaint custom. When their daughters are about 2-3 years old, they put a half saucer, half plate in their, between their gum and their upper lip, and it stretches the upper lip. As they get older, they put a bigger half saucer, until when they are mature, they're teenagers, their upper lip sticks out at least 8-9 inches. You ever saw what? No, that's not true. By them, no. By them, it's beauty. If you don't have an upper lip that sticks out 8 inches by the Ubangis, you'll never find the shiva. On the other hand, in America, if you have a daughter that has an 8-inch protruding upper lip, you send her to the orthodontist, spend thousands of dollars to fix it up, otherwise she'll never find the shiva. I had a daughter who needed orthodonture work. I was thinking of sending her to the Ubangis. It would have been cheaper. But the Shidduchim, they were a little too black for me, so I decided that didn't send her there. In any case, so, which is it? It says that Esther, no se schein de ene koro eva. Esther found favor in everybody's eyes. Everybody thought she was charming. How could that be? Did she have an upper lip that protruded 8 inches or not? If she did, the Ubangis thought she was great, but the Americans thought she was ugly. If she didn't, the Americans thought she was great and the Ubangis thought she was ugly. So which was it? So what's beauty? It says that Sari Menu was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. The Chora, a 20-year-old girl, is clearer than a 7-year-old girl. But there's a certain kind of beauty that does not depend on cultural subjectivity. There's a certain kind of beauty that is universal. That is the beauty of a 7-year-old. The beauty of innocence, of youth. That beauty is a universal. It's not a subjective kind of beauty. That's the kind of beauty that Sari Menu had. She projected a certain innocence that reflected her inner holiness externally, but in an external way. When you saw her, the way she carried herself, the way she looked, you could see holiness. You could see this is somebody, there's a certain charm, a certain beauty that reflects the inner beauty of a person. That's what the Vilna Gaon means. In a woman who has Yiras Shamayim, her outer beauty that reflects that is also important. Because we live in a physical world and we need to be able to see and be affected aesthetically by the externals too. We have to know the external is not the main thing. There's a more important internal. But once you understand that, then if you can see that internal value projected externally, that's the idea. So therefore, clothing has two purposes. On the one hand, it emphasizes the fact that there's something more than meets the eye involved here. Don't be distracted by the external, look to the internal. But once you do that, then the external clothing reflects that beauty, internal beauty. And that's why the clothing of the Kohanim had two functions. One, lekadsho lekanoli, to bring out that inner kedusha. At the same time, once it brought out the inner kedusha, lekavod l'tiferes, it brought it out in a way that that kedusha was transmitted and reflected externally to reflect what is that beauty of that inner holiness that the Kohen had, how beautiful and glorious it was reflected externally by the clothing. That's the two ideas. The one, yes. Yeah. The conclusion was that since this Sedra, Moshe Rabbeinu had to induct the Kohanim, and one could think that he would feel slighted, so the Torah made it a point that Moshe Rabbeinu corrected that flaw. And when he said, erase me from your book, he was totally altruistic, right? That he had no identity. So in this Sedra, where Moshe had to appoint and induct the Kohanim, he's just another you. He doesn't feel any slight that it's Aaron and not Moshe. I'm not Moshe, I'm just you. And any you could do it. So let's speak about a little bit about Purim. What is the message of Purim? Okay? Purim is another incident in history where we fought Amalek in the guise of Haman. I said in the past that Amalek represents atheism, as opposed to most of our other enemies who were idol worshippers. An idol worshipper believes that there is an intelligent force or forces that guide the world. An atheist believes in no intelligent force. Everything is just haphazard, accident, coincidence, totally unguided, and no intelligence. Evolution. Blind, creatorless, godless evolution. The difference between a idol worshipper and an atheist vis-a-vis us is, do they at least acknowledge that there's something special about us? They may hate us. They may resent it. They may be jealous. They may deny it. But do they have to admit that on the surface there appears to be something special about the Jewish people? An idol worshiper has to admit that. Why? Because what is special about us? We are not the strongest people in the world. We are not the most numerous people in the world. We're not even the smartest people in the world. Just look at the Knesset. Right? We are not even the richest people in the world, right? Especially after Madoff, we are not the richest people in the world, but even before him, we're not the richest people in the world, right? Bill Gates is not converted yet, right? Rockefeller was not Jewish, to say the least. Buffett is not Jewish. Richest people in the world, not necessarily. What?
The average is very high for us.
Okay, fine, but we're still, that's not the main thing, that we are the richest people in the world. So what is it? Torah says what's special about us. Two things. Mi goy gadol, asher lo Elohim krovim elav kashem Elokeinu b'chol koreinu elav. Who has a closer relationship with God, that God is always there for us as a people in the long run, and hears our prayers? Yes, we've had very, very difficult times. We've had holocausts and inquisitions, but we're still around. As a people, we've survived all of them. That means that, unlike other nations that have gone through difficulties and don't exist anymore, we still exist. Mark Twain pointed this out. He recognized this. And it shows that there's some power. If you don't believe in God, but you believe in intelligent powers that run the world, idolatry, you have to say there's some kind of God that favors us and kept us around. That we've survived all of this. And second thing is, Mi goy gadol asher lo chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim kechol haTorah hazos asher anochi noseim lefneichem hayom. What nation has such a perfect Torah with laws that govern every aspect of life, which shows that we're important? Because obviously this God that favors us is concerned what we eat, what we speak, what we think, what we dress, when we work. Means it's important. If it wouldn't be important, who cares? It must be that everything we do is important to him. And it has eternal and universal implications. That shows how important we are. These are the two important aspects of the Jewish people. If you're an idolater, you recognize that these things can exist. There can be a nation that has a closeness to a God and can pray to him. You also believe in intelligent forces that run the world. And you believe that there's right and wrong and moral and immoral. You may totally get it topsy-turvy and make moral immoral and right wrong and vice versa. But you believe that the concept exists because there's intelligence that runs the world. If there's intelligence, then there's a purpose. If there's a purpose, then there's something that's positive in that purpose and something negative. detrimental to that purpose. There's good and there's bad. But if you're an atheist, neither of those things makes any sense. It doesn't exist. You can't be close to a God who doesn't exist. You can't pray when there's no intelligent forces controlling the world. It's all just accident. That who are you praying to? What are you praying for? And there can't be any intrinsic morality, because if everything's an accident by definition is purposeless. And if there's no purpose, there can't be right, wrong. There's just accident. So what morality can atheists have? Situational ethics. Don't step on my toes, because I'll step on your toes, and we won't be able to exist. So, what's it called? We'll get along, but there can't be anything wrong with stepping on toes, because toes are accidental. They evolved accidentally. An ant evolved accidentally. Can there be something wrong with stepping on that ant? It's an accident. And the neighbor, there can't be anything wrong with stepping on your aunt from Chicago either, because she also is an accident. She's more accidents than the aunt was. So there can't be any intrinsic morality in an atheistic society. There can only be contrived ethics, how we can make it that people should live together. But that there's something intrinsically wrong or right, impossible. So there's no such thing as a Torah. If you're an idolater, you recognize that there's a system of ethics. You may distort it, but you have to recognize, and most idolaters recognize the Bible. Bible is a book of books. They may not agree with it. They may not think it's enforced, but it's something to reckon with. But if you're an atheist, there can't be a Bible. It's all jabber. So the atheist, who's Amalek, looks at us with disdain. We are nothing. And what bothers the atheist is we're a nothing that thinks we're something. On the other hand, the idolaters also don't like us for the most part. But they don't like us because we're something. And they resent that something. I think that's reflected in the Gemara. The Gemara says that when Haman offered Achashverosh Aseres Salafim Kikar Kesef, 10,000 talents of silver for the rights to destroy the Jewish people, what did Achashverosh say? Keep your money and do what you want with the people. So the Gemara gives an example, an allegory. There was a man who had a field with a big mound of earth on it. And it bothered him. He wanted to get rid of it. And another man had a big pit in his field, big hole, and he was looking for landfill to fill it up. One day the guy with the pit in his field passes by the field of the guy with the big mound of earth. He knocks on his door. He says, can you sell me this mound of earth? I could use it to fill up the hole in my field. He said, sell it to you. I'm looking for somebody to take it for free. Just get rid of it. So that was Achashverosh and Haman. But what do we see? How did Achashverosh, the idolater, see us? As a big mound of earth. Something that bothered him. We're something. But that something bothered him. Haman, the Amaleki, looks us up like a big crater. We're nothing. And that's what others say. That nothing stinks of something. And that's why when Haman had to destroy he had something against Mordecai, it was demeaning to him to deal with one Jew. Jews are worthless. They're nothing. So kill them all. Vayivez be'enov l'shloach yad b'Mordecai levado. And that's why Haman, the atheist, decided to destroy us by casting a lot. He peeled poor hu hagoro. Most people understand that to be a translation. He cast a poor, which, if you don't know what a poor is, it's a lot, gora. That makes sense if the word poor is Persian. So the Megillah wanted to keep the flavor of how Haman called it, but we don't know what the word poor is, so it translated into Hebrew, gora. But there's a problem with that, because it translates it twice in the Megillah, in the third parak and the ninth parak. Did the Anshik Nesagdola, who wrote Megillah Esther, think that we're feeble-minded? That we wouldn't remember from six prakim later what it is? We have to translate it twice. And according to many opinions, poor is a Hebrew word. It comes from the word perurim, small little crumbs. That's how lots are drawn. And if that's the case, it's a Hebrew word, why do I have to translate it? So what do you tell me? Well, poor was an archaic Hebrew word. And gora was the more used word. Then just tell me gora. It's not a thesaurus, it's Megillah Esther. Say, he peeled gora. Why do I need to hear the word poor altogether? I think it's not a translation. I think it's a slogan. He peeled poor. Haman cast a poor. And he said, Hu HaGorol, that is your destiny. You have no destiny. Your destiny is just chance. And therefore, in a world of chance and accident and coincidence, who runs the world? Those who have might. Survival of the fittest. And I'm the mighty one, I have the money, and I'm going to be the one to decide your fate. Because poor, the fate, the destiny is only the draw of a lot. There's no intelligent guiding God in this world. What was the miracle of Purim? It showed both of these things. One, that God does direct the world, and he's involved. And even when it appears that he's not there, he's behind the scenes. And if that's the case, that God guides the world, then we are very important. Because if there is a God, and God does guide the world, then we have a special close relationship with God, and we have a Torah that shows that God considers everything we do important. If there is no God, then both of those things are meaningless and we have no importance. So Purim teaches two lessons. Firstly, that God is always there. That's brought out by the mitzvah Megillas Esther, reading the Megillah. Megillah looks like God's name's not there. It looks like a bunch of coincidences. But if you take all the things together, you see there must be a guiding force behind all of this. It's too much to be a coincidence. So the Megillah reminds us that God is there, even in times when it appears that he's not. Don't see him visibly. He's behind the scenes. If that's the case, then Purim tells me that we're important as a Jewish people. And we have to rejoice in our importance in God's eyes. Because what makes us important is we have a special relationship with God, and we have a Torah that God gave us that shows that he considers everything we do important. So, therefore, the second mitzvahs of Purim reflect that importance. If you consider your life important, you want to promote it. You want to strengthen it. How do you do that? Eat. That promotes life, eating. So there's a mitzvah to eat on Purim. Sit down to a meal and promote and add to your life. But I'm not doing because I'm important. I'm important because I'm a Jew. So give another Jew something to eat. Yishlach Manos. Give him to promote his life because he's another Jew. He's also important. And it's not just Jews who have other things that make them important. We may be smart, rich, whatever it may be. But give the Evyom, the guy who has nothing, give him a present. You know why? Because presents go to important people and he's important. Because you don't need anything extra. Just being Jewish makes you important. Because you have a special relationship with God and you have a Torah. And it shows that God considers you important. So give the present to the Evyom. Right? That is what Purim says. Purim teaches me God is always there. God eventually, in the eternal perspective, will save us. And even if we don't see that salvation in certain generations, we see the opposite. We have hope because we know God didn't abandon us. He's there behind the scenes. There's a reason. There's a purpose. There's a goal. There's a plan. And God is directing things behind the scenes and eventually we'll be saved. And the second thing is, Lahodia, Shekoko Vecholo, we have nothing to be ashamed about. We should be proud that we are Jews. And and we will not be insulted by others forever. Short term, the guy you may not recognize that, they may insult us. But long term, even the nations of the world will recognize who we are and what we are, and we will not be insulted long term, and we have nothing to be embarrassed about personally, even on the short term.